You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising San.
Welcome to another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore. And before we turn to Nora Barris-Friedman today, an update from World Can't Wait's West Coast organizer, Stephanie Tang.
I am currently facing criminal charges in Alameda County for protesting against the war and against military recruiters. And the specific incident that the charge comes out of, it was one of several demonstrations, many demonstrations actually, that have been going on and started up in front of the Berkeley Marine Corps recruiter station in downtown Berkeley, which was opened up in 2007. And from everything we can tell, historically, this is the first time in at least decades that the military has dared to have a recruiting station in Berkeley, of all places. But they opened one. A few months later, protests began. Code Pink and other organizations began almost weekly and then daily protests. And by early last year, 2008, World Can't Wait had joined in, and we began organizing these very spirited, high-profile protest actions there that especially attracted a lot of young people. The basic theme was the military recruiters are signing people up for an illegitimate war, an illegal war, an immoral war, and they're signing people up to go over to places like Iraq and Afghanistan and to commit war crimes, and that's just not tolerable. And World Can't Wait, every time we organized a protest, we did attract a lot of support, but also media attention and also the attention of the police. And then in February, the Berkeley City Council, January and February, Berkeley City Council made national news by voting to send the Marine Corps a letter saying that they should leave town because the Marines were unwelcome intruders because Berkeley is a very anti-war city. And that kicked off a whole firestorm of right-wing radio-generated attacks on Berkeley for being so anti-war, which it very historically has been, and it's a very righteous position to take. And the right wing, through these radio stations, basically organized a whole mobilization at a time when, you know, if you think back a year ago, the Bush regime was still very hard at it. They were carrying out their whole program. The torture with impunity was way out there in public, in the public eye. The endless war and the occupation and the whole series of things going on internally in this country in terms of the destruction of civil liberties and just everything heading in a very fascistic direction. So this face-off between the anti-war and pro-war people over the Berkeley recruiting station, when it had World Can't Wait in the mix, but when it was also so hotly contested, you know, much more widely than just the movement, because of Berkeley's history. This caused national media attention, and there were just constant protests going on, and there was a day, 36 hours actually, when, again through the right-wing radio, this invasion was mobilized of several hundred pro-war flag-waving people, a lot of them bikers, and they came to city council, and they were going to park in front and demand that the city council apologize to the country for kicking the Marines out of Berkeley. And so a couple of thousand people supporting the city council gathered in front of City Hall for those 36 hours and faced them off and said, no, this is an absolutely good position, and we think the city council was absolutely right. And so in that whole time period, January, February, there was ongoing a series of small demonstrations, never more than 50 or 60 or 70 people, organized by World Can't Wait outside the Marine Corps station. You know, they were very, very spirited demonstrations, and they were always nonviolent political protest. Sometimes there was civil disobedience. Sometimes we had speakouts and banners and signs, but it was always about our political message. And so we were demonstrating and bringing our message to the public and getting a lot of support, a lot of honking and waving from the traffic and so forth. But these demonstrations were repeatedly attacked by the Berkeley police, and people were very astonished because typically in Berkeley you can sort of protest anything, but lately things have gotten a lot harsher on things like the World Can't Wait protests and things like the tree sits up at UC. And our protests at the Marine Station were attacked 3 times in a row within a couple of weeks by the Berkeley police, all dressed up in their riot gear. And we were assaulted several times. They would march out into our crowd and knock over our sound equipment and, you know, push people around and generally just try to create a whole scenario that looked violent, that was meant to intimidate people, both ourselves, maybe, but also people watching, and to make our demonstrations look like something you wouldn't want your teenage children to participate in. Mm-hmm. So it was in one of those protests on February 22nd that the police charged a group of us, about 25 of us, and their pretext was that they had to stop one fellow from using a bullhorn. He was leading chants, and we were walking down the street. And they charged the crowd, and one cop hit me with his baton so hard, he sent me flying headfirst into a brick wall. Mm. However, I was not arrested. And a lot of people immediately, you know, were very, very angry, and the police later claimed to the DA that they didn't arrest me that day because they were afraid that that would cause a riot. And so I wasn't arrested. I didn't go to jail that day. I went to the hospital that evening to get looked at by a doctor, and the police came barging into the emergency room demanding that I give them a statement, which I didn't, but they didn't arrest me there either. And, in fact, I've never been arrested for this incident. I got a letter in the mail weeks later from the DA saying that I was being charged with obstruction of an officer, and it's a charge that carries a year in jail and a $1,000 fine. I was about to go on trial in February, but now the trial date is set for May 4th.
And has there been any legal proceedings?
Oh, yeah, there's been some back and forth with the DA. I have a really great civil rights attorney representing me. His name is Walter Riley, and he goes back himself as a resistor back to the early days of the civil rights movement in the South with CORE and SNCC. And he's been in Oakland for many years, and he both defends a lot of sort of ordinary people getting in trouble with the law, as well as political cases. And so we've been in court several times over the year just for preliminary back and forth. Mm. But it's very clear that the DA is not dropping the charge. Everyone who's been arrested at the Marine Recruiting Station has either had their charges not even filed or dropped. This is the only case. I'm the only person who's going to trial for these protests.
What do you make of that?
I think it has a couple of different sources, possibly. I think one is that when Berkeley became nationally infamous for standing up against the war, it drew a lot of ire from the government, because if you can just imagine if more cities were to do what Berkeley did and start kicking the recruiters out of town and saying that they were unwelcome, that would put a big crimp in the escalation that's now going on, where they're, you know, Obama's announced that they need to put 90,000 additional troops into uniform in the next short period of time, and, you know, he's sending 17,000 more into Afghanistan, so they really need recruits, and where they're going to go get these kids is in the high schools and the college campuses. And so protesting against military recruiters is actually a very, very sharp way to challenge the war itself. Recruiters are doing very, very deadly work, and the city was sort of mounting a defense in its behalf in the media, saying, well, you know, the recruiters have a right to recruit. And, you know, I mean, our position in World Can't Wait is, if the recruiters have a right to recruit you into this war, then the Iraqi people don't have a right to live. It's sort of not possible for that both rights to be equal.
Yes. On another note, though, the recruiters really don't choose this job. This is a job that they're pushed into, and they have to come up with a certain number of people. They have a quota system. And so the recruiters themselves often are very stressed out. I know there's been some significant suicides among the recruiter contingencies, too.
Yeah, I've read a lot about that, too, and about the suicide rate just overall of the returning veterans. But, you know, these recruiters do have a choice. There are heroic people, men and women, who've been in uniform. They've been in combat, many of them, and they have become resistors. They have gone into resistance and refused their orders, refused return tours of duty, faced court martials, faced jail, you know, faced being outcast sometimes from their families and communities for refusing to go along with the war anymore. And so I guess I would say that is an option
yeah.
that everyone in uniform has.
Stephanie, how can folks stay in touch with what unfolds with your court case?
Okay, I'm going to trial May 4th, and you can get in touch with us at our chapter email, SF, that's like San Francisco, at worldcantwait.org, no apostrophe in the can't. And you can call us at 415-864-5153.
Stephanie, we will stay in touch with you, and certainly we'll want to know what comes down after the May 4th trial.
Okay, well, definitely people are welcome, and we encourage people who can to come with us to court. It's very meaningful and important for the courtroom to be full of people who actually believe that, you know, what has to happen is that the whole case should be thrown out.
So March 19th is the 6th anniversary of the war. Join a rally in Berkeley at 3 p.m. at Martin Luther King Park next to Berkeley High School. For more details, call 415-864-5153 or email sf@worldcantwait.org. Nora Barris-Friedman is a senior producer at KPFA's Flashpoints, and she's engaged in bringing her radio arts and talents to Palestinian youth in the West Bank's Taisha refugee camp. She spends the rest of the hour with us today, and I began by asking her how she got involved in this project.
6 years ago, I felt like I needed to get back into radio. I had gone through a youth training program called Youth Radio when I was in high school, when I was 15 and 16, and it was in a partnership with KPFA, and I learned radio production, editing, and also interviewing and kind of directing skills. And then I went on to become a peer teacher and then went to work at a corporate radio station. And then I left radio for a while, went to college, had a baby. And then September 11th happened a few years later. And I was looking at my little tiny child and weeping about the state of the world. And I just felt like I couldn't possibly be paralyzed. I had to do something political, and I had to get involved in some way, join the global resistance against war and militarism and everything that was happening with our names. And at the same time, I was also listening to a lot of Democracy Now! And Flashpoints and Free Speech Radio News, really absorbing as much as I could of what was happening in the global context of not just the U.S. going to war against innocent people in Afghanistan at the time and the drumbeat of war against people in Iraq, but also how Palestine was fitting into that context, how Haiti was fitting into that context, how domestic terrorism here against people of color and immigrants and poor people in this country was also fitting into that context. And so I started volunteering at KPFA, just answering phones during a fund drive. I met Dennis Bernstein, the host of Flashpoints, and I said, look, I'd love to be your intern. I have a young child, and I'm not working at this moment, but I would love to spend, you know, some afternoons when she goes to preschool doing whatever I can. If you need help, you know, I'm a graduate of youth radio. My mom's a poet, you're a poet. I tried to like ingratiate myself as much as I could. And he said, oh, youth radio. Okay, great. Yeah, okay, when can you start? I said, well, as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And I started my internship at Flashpoints the day that Bush's shock and awe campaign began in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of inundated by these stories all of a sudden, and it became very personal to me. I was on the phone with people inside Iraq as bombs were falling. But at the same time, Dennis said, well, you know, Palestine has been our story here on Flashpoints for over a decade. And since all this is happening in Iraq, I need someone to take over the story of Palestine. So he kind of like shoved Palestine in my lap. And I said, oh, all right. I had no idea the amount of personal attachment I would get from this story until I actually actively started reporting on it and then going there myself. Mm-hmm. So in 2003, I began my internship. By the middle of 2003, I was an associate producer, working 20 hours a week. And then in 2004, I said, this is ridiculous. I can't report on this region without going there myself and seeing it with my own eyes. I'm a visual person. It's how I learn. It's how I attach myself to stories, especially human interest stories, is by going there. I did a lot of traveling as a young adult. My mom sent me to Cuba by myself when I was 11 to go to a socialist camp, you know, and so travel has always been a really important aspect of my growth as a woman, as a human being, and especially as a journalist. So in 2004, I went with the Middle East Children's Alliance, based here in Berkeley, on a delegation to Palestine, and that's where I fell in love with the Ibdea Cultural Center inside Dehesha Refugee Camp, which is just outside of Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. They invited me to be a media coordinator. And so for the last 5 years, I've been going there and working with kids inside the refugee camp to do digital media, journalism, all sorts of recording and engineering and photography.
It's the dream job that fell into your lap.
Yeah, definitely.
We're definitely going to talk about the camp and more detail about that, but I want to go back to your point about being a visual person, that it's easier for you to understand something. As I'm understanding what you're saying, it's easier to understand something if you're actually there.
Yeah.
I'm like that too. And so it's part of why I think it's so important for us, especially in America, to travel and to places that we hear a lot about.
Right.
We have some sense that we know what's going on, but in fact, we only once we get there do we really understand some of what is happening for people.
Right.
So talk a little about that. You went for the first time to see.
I went for the first time to see with my own eyes what I was hearing from people on the other side of the world through the telephone and on email and on reports that I was reading online and all this stuff.
So you didn't really know much about the history at that point?
I didn't at that point, but as soon as the story fell into my lap, I read everything I could get my hands on. I became friends with the people who were our correspondents inside Gaza and the West Bank. And when I got there, it changed my life forever. I mean, it really did, because the thing about Palestine is that I always tell people, like, you have to take off your logical thinking cap and put it aside, because this story and this situation in particular is so illogical, and it's so simple yet complicated at the same time. There's like this overarching like dichotomy of this like simplistic. It could be so simple. If Israel didn't kick out the indigenous people, there wouldn't be all of the suffering. But then, yet, there's also this incredibly complicated nature of the situation as well. It's like, like this land in particular has been the scene of so many crimes and so many exoduses and conflicts and wars and occupations since the beginning of human civilization. And is this one more chapter of that same story? Yes and no. And the people are so beautiful, and yet there's so much violence and kind of like our human nature, our propensity to be at the same time extremely beautiful and gracious and humble, and the best facets of human nature are there, as well as the worst, as well as stealing other people's land and bombing them and building edifices on top of graveyards, and like all these horrible things that we abhor about human nature are right next to the things that we love the most.
The paradox of life.
Exactly. And so that is just, being a visual person and a verbal person, like this poetic, metaphoric symbolism of exactly who we are, and in all of our beauty and terror at the same time, really kind of pulled at me. And then going into it and looking at Palestine in the lens of modern day colonialism and modern day imperialism, modern day trauma and terror and all of that. There is no better example than what's happening in Palestine to the indigenous people.
So let me ask you to describe your first impression of the wall.
The
security
wall.
Barrier, the wall, the apartheid wall. It has all of the fence.
Right.
Talk about the first. There's the concrete wall. There's the wire wall. But the concrete wall. Let's talk about that.
Concrete wall. The first time I saw it was in East Jerusalem, kind of like in the border between Jerusalem and Bethlehem, and it's just this unbelievably ugly structure. It's 30 feet high. It's just like put right down the middle. Like the first time I saw it, it's kind of right down the middle of this one road in East Jerusalem, and it separates the neighborhood. Basically, like if you're next door, you know, your across the street neighbor was there for generations. And used to go, you know, the families used to go and, you know, their kids would play and, you know, they'd have parties and neighborhood block party, you know, stuff like that. And that neighborhood is now inaccessible to the neighbors. So, you know, what was once just a normal, you know, suburb of Jerusalem is now a total ghetto.
Divided.
Totally divided, totally ghettoized.
When I drive along the freeway down 880, I sometimes think of that wall because they have the structures there, but actually the wall in Israel, the concrete wall, is actually taller than that.
Oh, yeah, much taller. I mean, it's twice the height of the Berlin Wall, if you can imagine that. Like, and the Berlin Wall, you know, it's such an ingrained symbol of division and conflict. And no one ever thought that wall was going to come down, and now we have this wall that's twice the height, that's 700 kilometers I think in total length as it snakes around the West Bank, and they're building phase three now, which is going to be along the eastern West Bank, so through the Jordan Valley, cutting people off from their land, cutting water resources off, cutting people off from hospitals and schools and clinics. Places of, you know, work and worship. I mean, it's just such an egregious structure. And there's something so violent in nature about putting this ugly gray concrete wall through a neighborhood that has been there and contiguous for thousands of years.
And the implication that we don't actually get at when we talk about putting the wall up is that houses are actually demolished to do that.
Yeah, of course.
People's houses.
Right.
And we know that we've had thousands and thousands of houses, literally thousands and thousands of houses demolished, not only because of the wall, but that's something. And I know when I first encountered that wall, I had this sense of something gray looming over me.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a sound, the sounds sort of die down. I mean, it's like being an alternate reality, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I'll give you the example of this one West Bank city of Qalqilia, which has been a city since, like, you know, biblical times. It's been this, it's right on the western edge of the northern West Bank, and it's in some of the most fertile land in the entire region of the Levant. So it's like, just, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, it's been this just beautiful, fertile, agricultural paradise in Palestine, and in 2002, the Israeli military started building the wall around Qalqilia, so much so that it actually built the wall encircling the entire city, so that there's one entrance in and out of the city. So a city of 25,000-30,000 people is bottlenecked through this one gate in and out. And the wall is, again, 30 feet high. It's monstrous. It encircles the entire village. And I remember when I was there in 2004, and the first time I was in Palestine, the first time I was in Qalqilia, a farmer, sarcastically mentioned that that in Qalqilia they get their sunsets an hour or two early, earlier than the rest of Palestine gets them, because the sun actually dips behind the wall first. So there's like an artificial horizon, and they get their sunsets earlier than the rest of the people there. And there's something, again, this inherent violence and this like wretched nature of collectively punishing the indigenous people for existing in the first place. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the point of encircling a huge, ancient city with this ugly wall.
Well, what do you think the point is?
The point is to make Palestinians so incredibly miserable, to make their lives so wretched beyond belief that they leave. And this is like what Ilan Pappé called a sociocide. This is genocide, this is ethnic cleansing, but it's like a passive ethnic cleansing. It's a passive genocide because you're not just hacking people to death with machetes like in Rwanda. You know, of course, there's bombings and there's killings every day in Palestine. But there's like this slow-moving, passive genocide happening underneath of making life so unbearable that Palestinians take their stuff and leave.
Except most of them, the Palestinians that I've talked when I was there, said, we will never leave.
That's right.
We are not leaving.
Well, I think the Israelis and the Zionists underestimated the resilience and the resistance and the stubbornness of Palestinians. Mm. And so Palestinians are still there. The massacres do happen. There still is an ethnic cleansing. But the Palestinian people themselves are staying put as much as they can. I mean, there is a brain drain happening now because of the lack of freedom of movement and the restrictions on education within the occupied Palestinian territories by the Israeli government. Many people who can afford it are leaving Palestine to go study elsewhere in the United States or in Europe or Latin America or elsewhere in Western Asia. And some of them come back. A lot of them don't. Mm-hmm. And they become part of the growing diaspora of Palestinians, which is the largest diaspora in the world in modern history. 6 million Palestinians live outside of Palestine. Either they were forced out from the original expulsion in 1948, again in 1967, and now we're 4 or 5 generations after that. So. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's the refugees inside the refugee camps inside the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. And then there's millions of others who are all waiting to go home.
So let's move to the refugee camps. Here again, I think it needs to be emphasized that within this land where people have grown up are refugee camps.
Yeah.
People, I know when I was in Lebanon recently, someone said, he had been in South Lebanon. He'd walked as far as he could using binoculars to see his parents' village. It was called Marun. It was northern part of Israel now. And that was, it just was so sad to hear someone looking over a land that he feels his heart and his being belongs to, and he can't get any closer. He can only, and there's nothing there anymore. There may be some prickly pears or something. But he grew up in one of the camps in Mayamea, in Sidon area.
Yeah.
And so I think that I'd like to spend a little time talking about the fact that there are people living in camps in their homeland.
Right. Yeah, it's an amazing idea. In the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan, there's 59 refugee camps, I believe, altogether. And, in Dehesha camp, for example, where I'm based when I'm there, where I do a lot of my work, inside Dehesha refugee camp, there's 12,000 people, and about 57% are under 18, so there's a majority children. And they come from about 40 different villages that either no longer exist on any map because they were destroyed by the Zionist militias in the 1940s, or they've been turned into what is now Israeli towns and cities. So like my friend Ziad, who is the co-founder of the cultural center that I work and am based at in the refugee camp, he comes from a village called Zakaria. And Zakaria is only about 25 minutes outside of Bethlehem now. Like, if there was no wall, if there were no checkpoints, if Palestinians, had the right of return to even go back to their villages, they're not allowed inside what's now considered to be Israel without special permission. It would take 25 minutes to get from Bethlehem to Zakaria. Zakaria now is called Zecharia, and it's a quaint little Israeli town. And in Zechariah, I'll still call it Zechariah because Ziad calls it Zechariah, and the refugees from Zechariah still call it Zechariah, of course. When I went with Ziad to Zechariah last summer when I was there, he was showing me the houses that were built then, or that were built right after the expulsion of his family in 1948, and he showed me this wall that was built along the road, and the wall was made up of all these beautiful stones, like really gorgeous, like sand-colored stones. It's ubiquitous all over Palestine. And he said that these stones, this wall, was made from the stones that were part of houses that were destroyed by the Zionists. So the Zionists came in, and they expelled these people. They set fire to houses. They forced these people out of their homes with, you know, minutes sometimes notice. And then after a while, they took whatever what was left of those homes and built a wall against the road, and then took more of them and built homes for Israeli families. And these homes still exist like that. And there's also homes that were saved. There's like an old mosque that's now deteriorating and has become a junkyard for this town. And it's just like, you can imagine how much anger and frustration and what a demoralizing, dehumanizing process that these Palestinians have had to go through for 61 years and four or five generations. And to think that there are millions of Palestinians who are waiting to go home to villages that are just minutes away from where they are now, and that there is a process in place, a system in place that keeps them from having that basic human right of choosing where they can live.
And yet the history that we've learned doesn't really address that, does it?
No, never.
The history that it seems to pass for the history really isn't the actual history. It's a history of one-sided view, and it's very difficult to get the other view up. I mean, it's almost like we, quote-unquote, don't want to hear that history.
Absolutely. I mean, we have the dominant narrative, which is the Jewish story, the Israeli story. I grew up, I'm a Jew. My parents are Jewish. They grew up in, pretty conservative. My mom grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family. Mm. Both of her grandparents were rabbis.
In the United States?
In Brooklyn. We were refugees from Eastern Europe, from Lithuania and Poland and all these places that were changing borders and names and forcing the Jews out because of pogroms and all of this, and we came from that history, and a third of my relatives were exterminated in the Nazi Holocaust. But there's never been a sense, I was never taught that Palestinians should pay the price for what was done to my family. I grew up in actually a very anti-Zionist household, where both of my parents never instilled in me a sense of entitlement just because I'm Jewish, just because I have this history of extreme violence done toward my people. There's no reason why there should be an impetus to turn around and do that to another indigenous population. That's the narrative that we're told, especially as American Jews, where this was done to us, we should never let it happen again, and therefore we have to be as militant and as nationalistic as possible, tied to this land, which is not ours, which was created for us on the basis of denying human rights for another. How wrong and how kind of twisted morally is that?
Well, how does your family, your extended family now, what do they think of the work that you're doing?
Luckily, my family is really supportive. My extended family, like my relatives, all my grandparents and great aunts and uncles have all passed away. And they passed away before I started doing this work. I'm not sure. I think about that a lot. I think about if they were alive today, what would they think? And I think they would be pretty opposed to it.
To your work?
To my work, yeah. But my mom and my dad have been really, really supportive.
Have they been over there?
My mom has, yeah. My mom actually, over the past few years, she's been going and she's a psychotherapist, and she deals, her specialty is childhood trauma and chronic learning disorders based on traumatic experiences, and autism and learning disabilities as well. So she's gone over there a couple mm-hmm. times and worked with the Palestinian psychotherapists and psychiatrists to kind of look at their caseload and help diagnose chronically traumatized children because of their situation mm-hmm. under military occupation and dispossession and, you know, terrorism.
That's wonderful to have a mom that has, I will say, stepped up to the plate so fully and taken this on.
And it is rare. And it's rare in the Jewish community, I think, in the American Jewish community.
Yeah.
So I'm lucky in that respect.
So I believe you've started radio work there.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, I've been working with Ibdea on and off to help establish a community radio station inside the camp. And once it's up, once we're actually live on the air, it'll be the first radio station based inside a Palestinian refugee camp in the world. So that's really exciting. And it'll be mostly maintained and run and programmed by young people in the camp.
It's amazing. Did you need a permit, or what was the
legality
around
that? Yeah, we've actually applied for a broadcasting license from the Palestinian Authority, which, because it's under military occupation, has to be approved by the Israeli administration.
I'm curious about that.
And that's taking time, but they're still hopeful that that'll happen.
Do they give you a time frame within which they will respond?
No.
No. But you can't broadcast unless you've got that permit.
Right. And there's always the possibility that the Israelis will destroy the broadcasting tower, you know, the transmitter. There's always that possibility. I think that's happened before. That happens all the time in Gaza. Just recently, actually, during the December and January massacres that happened, a lot of the radio and cell phone towers were destroyed by Israeli warplanes. So there's that possibility, but there's also, I'm also trying to help launch an internet radio station, which you don't need a broadcast license for. So that's my main project over the next few months, is to really work with both Palestinian and international radio broadcasters, with community radio stations, to help establish the first internet radio station as well.
So talk about the vision for the radio station. There are young people that are studying.
Young people that are interested in media and journalism and production and, catchphrase of new media, which also encompasses, like, visual production, so, like, you know, audio-visual, you know, little short movies and documentary film clips. The technology is getting so cheap and so easily accessible that it's really taken off, especially in Palestine, where people are very, very well educated, even under the most dire circumstances. The education is like a paramount facet of the culture. It has a lot to do with pride and identity and tenacity as a collective, you know, form of resistance even.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really important point to emphasize, is there's a sense that people are not that interested in education, but
right.
in fact...
It's accelerated the drive to become educated, and especially with journalism. I mean, you know, we're talking about, you know, the dominant narrative, which suppresses and silences the other side, the side of mm-hmm. those oppressed. And Palestinians know this very, very well. I mean, they're born into politics. They're born into being silenced. And so journalism and you know, kind of exposing the reality through their own voices in their own backyards has really taken off as kind of this, like, cultural initiative. Mm. So media is taking off. Internet is just all over the place.
So, in fact, you probably have a waiting list of young people who want to be involved in this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like, we, and it's very fluid and you know, there's no real process. When I go to the cultural center, I'm usually like, hey, I show up there and we're like, hey, who wants to, you know, talk about field recording and, you know, who wants to learn how to, you know, use this new, you know, MP3 player. So there's no real, like, you know, structure.
Nothing formal at this
exactly.
point.
Exactly. But there's always a group of kids who are just eager and willing to take time out of their day to learn about, you know, how they can amplify their own voices.
And so while you're there, you'll be doing this,
yeah.
this work. Will you also be traveling into, say, Gaza to do some radio work for...
I don't think I'm going to have enough time to get into Gaza. Also, it's very difficult to get into Gaza
now. From the Israeli
now.
Side.
Exactly. I'd have to probably go through Egypt and apply with Egyptian and Israeli authorities. And you know, there's a lot of wonderful reporters and human rights activists doing incredible documentation of the human rights nightmare that's unfolding in Gaza right now. And at the same time, there's not a lot of focus still on what's happening in the West Bank and inside 1948 Israel. There's a lot of stories inside the Green Line, inside Israel, that are not being told as well. There's a 20% of the population inside Israel is indigenous Palestinian, and their civil rights, their human rights are being denied, their home demolitions inside Israeli cities and towns. There's a lot of suppression of civil rights, especially with these new, like, right-wing hardliner Zionists in the government that were just elected and re-elected. And so a lot of my focus is also inside Israel and talking with both Israelis and Palestinians about the situation there. And I love that work as well.
So Chloe, getting in and out, I mean, you've now been in several times.
Yeah.
Right? Getting in and out is not becoming more difficult?
I mean, it's
you
not
You have to gear
bad.
Yourself up,
I
right?
do. I do, definitely. I mean, it's a very interesting dynamic that plays out when you enter Israel because, you know, if you're a certain skin color and your last name is Jewish or Jewish sounding, they don't give you much trouble. But if you're a Palestinian or an Arab American, someone who's even born in this country, who has an American passport or Canadian passport, they will interrogate and they will make it very difficult for you to enter.
Or if they think you're, the latest one I discovered was the word volunteer.
Yeah.
A volunteer is kind of someone to be skeptical about
right,
if you're part
exactly.
of the authorities.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, they also harass white American Christians as well. And if you go there and your focus is going to be mainly in the West Bank, they will make it very hard for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you kind of roll the dice and hope for the best. I'm hoping that it stays relatively easy for me to travel around. But, you know, there's people just... I was just speaking with Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories yesterday. He's a United Nations official. Like, he's he's like this dignitary. He's very well known. He's a member of the United Nations, which is an immune, you know, world international body who should be able to travel in and out as he pleases, especially if his job is to go and, you know, observe what's happening in the occupied territories. And in mid-December, he was at the airport, and the Israelis detained him for hours and hours and hours, and then denied him entry. And so, you know, anyone who's critical of Israeli policy, anyone who's public, anyone who goes there to witness what's happening on the ground, runs the risk of being denied entry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's always that possibility.
Yeah. We're talking today with Nora Barris Friedman, co-host of KPFA Radio's Flashpoints, which KPFA is also part of Pacifica, so our listeners can hear your voice on that network.
Yeah.
Make the Palestinians come alive.
I have friends who work in Nablus, which is in the northern West Bank, who live in Ramallah, which is kind of in the middle of the West Bank. And normally, if there were no checkpoints, it would take maybe about 35, 40 minutes on the highway to get from Ramallah to Nablus. But there are at least three, if not sometimes five or six checkpoints. And the reason why it fluctuates between three or five or six is because you have three permanent checkpoints, and then you also have what they call flying checkpoints. So all of a sudden, you know, 200, 300 meters after one checkpoint, they'll set up another checkpoint. It's like completely, there's no sense to it. It's illogical. Why would you set up a checkpoint 300 meters past an already established checkpoint? And then, you know, make Palestinians wait hours and hours and hours to get from one, you know, from point A to point B, to get to work, to get to school, to get to the hospital. And again, the intention is to make life miserable. And it's humiliating. It's humiliating for, you know, a 60, 70-year-old Palestinian man trying to get to the mosque to pray, for example, to be held up at a checkpoint for 3 hours while an 18-year-old Israeli soldier is talking on the phone with his friends, is smoking cigarettes, is, you know, texting his girlfriend, is eating his lunch, and prohibiting this man.
Who usually has taken the ID documentation,
they take
so he has to wait for it.
Exactly. So that's humiliating. Mm-hmm. And yet Palestinians persevere. And I don't want to paint all Israelis are not like that. There are some incredible groups and movements within Israeli society to help hold their government accountable. There are young people who are refusing to enter into the mandatory military service. They're called the refuseniks. They're these like 17, 18-year-old kids who are saying, "I'm not going to be part of this illegal occupation. You're not going to do this in my name." And there are, you know, there are groups of Israeli resistance activists, you know, who are going to checkpoints and blocking bulldozers from demolishing homes and locking down at Israeli Air Force bases when planes are being sent to bomb people in Gaza. There are people who are really actively resisting, and there's a sustained movement of resistance inside Israel. Who are working with Palestinians, invited by the Palestinians to work with them, to stand together. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of that going on as well. And as a Jewish American, it's very important for me to see those movements emerge and grow inside Israel. Because, you know, I walk around Tel Aviv, I walk around Jerusalem, and... You know, it's like everyone looks like me. You know, like, oh, there's my cousin over there. Mm-hmm. You know, in another life, I could have been an Israeli. Mm-hmm. My parents could have moved there. A lot of my friends' parents moved there when I was in high school, mm-hmm. in elementary school, and they're still there today. You know, I think it's only a matter of time before this structure, this policy, this uneven balance of power shifts, and Israeli society will have to contend with the fact that we're living in a world that is multicultural, that living in a monoculture, which is what Zionists are fighting for, if you can call it that, where everyone is Jewish, there's no indigenous Palestinians, there's no Muslims, there's no Christians. That what does that even serve? That what, you know, how boring is that? You know, growing up in Berkeley, like, I love being able to choose between 15 different kinds of restaurants from all over the world when I'm hungry. You know,
it's also against the Jewish tradition, though.
Absolutely.
Isn't it? I mean, Iraq had a very, very Iran, right. Syria, all of these places right. had very vibrant Jewish communities. Actually, right. I was in Syria in 2007, and people were saying how they missed the Jewish community there,
right.
that they were a great addition, and they right. really missed them.
And the Jews as a tribe, as a culture, as, you know, as a people, have been nomadic. We've gotten so much from different traditions. Like, you know, my family's half Sephardic and half Ashkenazi. So the Sephardic people of, like, you know, Spain and Morocco, Northern Africa, the Levant, you know, like really like Southern Europe and Middle Eastern people, you know, together with the Lithuanians and the Hungarians and the Balkans and, you know, the Russians and Poles. I mean, we were a nomadic people, and to stop that in its tracks and to force people to be monoculturist and it's just, it's such a tragedy.
What about the boycott and divestment programs?
This is a very exciting movement that's now really gaining momentum. I'm not an expert in South African history, but we're all very much aware that one of the main facets in bringing down South African apartheid in the 1990s was this growing global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against the white South African ruling elite. And it worked. I think in this kind of time in history, when capitalism, when economy is kind of the key to imperialism, when it's the key to power and resources, I think that going after states that practice apartheid and racism and entitlement and dispossession of indigenous peoples, whether it's in Palestine or whether it's here in this country, you know, whether it's in Haiti, whether, you know, wherever it is that this happens, in Iraq, Afghanistan, that to really go after these states and say, we're not going to do business with you if you're practicing these policies, just as we didn't do business with you when you practiced these policies in South Africa, has the ability to really turn the tide and create public, kind of this public relations nightmare for the states that practice these policies. And so now, in the context of Palestine, this global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is really gaining ground. And it's also not just economic, but it's cultural, it's academic. There are, you know, boycotts of Israeli cultural events, like dance groups. This one, I think, on the East Coast, this Israeli group was supposed to come and perform on the East Coast, and there's this massive boycott movement against it. There are boycotts of Israeli academics who are being told not to come and speak at U.S. institutions. You know, on the local level, our power, our vote is now through our checkbook, through our pocketbook. And so if we support genocide and dispossession and colonialization in Palestine, then by all means buy Israeli products. But if we don't support that, if we support human rights and dignity and justice and freedom for everybody, then it's incumbent upon ourselves to be mindful and to be conscious of how we vote with our checkbook, who we give money to, which items we can purchase and which ones we don't have to. Just the other week, I was with my daughter at Whole Foods on Telegraph Avenue here in Berkeley, and we were going to have like a fun mommy-daughter chocolate sundae party, which sometimes we do. And so we bought all the ingredients to make this wonderful chocolate sundae, and she and I really wanted to have some nice toppings. So we went to the marshmallow aisle, and the only marshmallows that Whole Foods stocked at that time, maybe they've changed since last week, were made in Tel Aviv. It said made in Israel, and it had an address of Tel Aviv on it. And so we didn't buy them. And she was upset because she wanted marshmallows. And I was like, you know, we can get marshmallows elsewhere. We don't have to buy these. There are choices that we can make so that we don't support what's happening in Palestine with our checkbooks. And then the next step is to organize in your community and say, okay, these are the products that are being sold in this community. We don't have to buy these. Here are alternatives. And we don't have to support Israeli academics who come to Berkeley. We can organize boycotts against that. And then we can also do sit-ins at our congressmen's and congresswomen's offices and demand that they take similar actions, because that's what happened to bring down South African apartheid, was popular movements in this country and elsewhere around the world held their local elected representatives accountable to also represent their constituency, who is not going to let apartheid happen on their watch. And so I think this is really happening, and this is the time when we can really galvanize our own communities to join the global boycott, divestment, sanctions movement.
Although I'm sitting here remembering Hillary Clinton the other day saying, well, are we going to pursue the two-state solution? And in fact, the two-state solution is highly unlikely anymore, is it? And it's highly unlikely because most of that land has been appropriated. There is no area that's left for another state.
Right. I mean, if you look at a map, the two-state solution is a joke. We have Gaza that's completely geographically separated from what's left of the West Bank. And I say what's left of the West Bank because it's been split into about 24 different Bantustans because of the settlement colonies and because of the settler-only roads and because of the apartheid wall. So really, if you look at a geopolitical map of what's left of Palestine right now, you have these two non-contiguous islands of Gaza and the West Bank, and then within the West Bank are all these, like, it looks like chicken pox.
I'm actually going to commit to putting an image up. I have an image of three different eras, the 48, I think 67, and then current map. I'll put that up on my radio website, so www.raisingsandradio.org. Listeners can go and see that if they don't, if they can't really visualize what you're saying.
And it's really important, again, you know, being a visual person, it's really important to see with your own eyes what politicians are saying politically, how their policies actually translate on the ground, on people's backs, in their lives. You know, we talk about the two-state solution. It's more, so, you know, with all these Bantustans, it's more like a 28-state solution, you know, since everything's...
In-solution.
Non-solution, right, exactly. So again, the only... Going back to, like, you know, how it's so complicated and yet so simple. In order to end the suffering on both sides, in order to end Israeli fear and paranoia that, you know, if they get on a bus, it might be blown up by a suicide bomber. And that's a very real fear. And I understand that fear. And if we want to end the suffering of the people in Palestine, where if they wake up, they might be bombed. And that's a very real fear that people have every day in Gaza on the ground. Mm. The only way to end that paradox of suffering is to establish one democratic, secular state for everyone. And the first step to the implementation of that one democratic state for everyone with basic human rights is the implementation of the Palestinian right of return. UN Resolution 194 that was passed in 1949 and ratified ever since, but vetoed ever since by the United States and Israel, maintains and guarantees Palestinians who have been displaced and expelled from their land the right to go back to their land. And Palestinians who are now 20 minutes away from their original villages still have hope and in the belief in the implementation of this right of return. That's the basic tenet of every human right, every basic human right of any human being on this planet, is to be able to choose where they can live, to be able to raise families in lands that were traditionally theirs for thousands of years. When we see that implementation of the right of return, when we see the construction of a one singular state for everybody, then we'll have peace all across the Middle East. When that issue is resolved, so goes the rest of the region, so goes the rest of the world, in my view and in many other people's views.
That was Nora Barris-Friedman, senior producer of KPFA Radio's Flashpoints, who's also involved in bringing radio arts to youth in the West Bank's Taisha refugee camp. If you go to our website, www.raisingsandradio.org, you can take a look at a map that illustrates Palestinian loss of land from 1946 to 2008. It's something that we mentioned during this show. So again, www.raisingsandradio.org. You can also do a search on the internet for information on the boycott and divestment campaigns. And that's our show for today. As usual, views expressed are those of the host and guests and not KZSU or Stanford University. Thanks for listening and join us again next week.